Hello friends, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. The show is independent and ad-free thanks to listeners like you. Just go to sewersofparis.com and click support the show on Patreon to keep it going for as little as a dollar an episode. Or support the show for free by leaving a review, or by posting about it on Facebook and Twitter. And now, we're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join me on tonight's episode when my guest says...
They did a strip tease, too, so it's like, oh, my son's naked, like, pretending to masturbate with the horn as Angel Moroni. So I had to have some phone calls with family members about that one.
The topic is PJ Harvey, Sylvia Plath, and Brokeback Mountain. My guest this week is Austin Bull, also known as the performance artist The Bearded Femme. His stage persona is eye-catching and strange, from vibrant green beards to dressing up as sexualized religious figures. Creating creatures on stage is his way of making sense of a darkness that once threatened to overwhelm him, and of standing up to his own fears. By the way, this Saturday, November 5th, you can catch me and my partner James live-streaming video games for 24 hours straight. It's a fundraiser for Seattle Children's Hospital, and you can watch and chat and donate as we play Skyrim, Final Fantasy, Smash Brothers, and lots more. While we play, we're asking viewers to chip in a few bucks to support research into childhood diseases. Just go to sewersofparis.com and click the Extra Life logo to watch and donate. We're starting at 9 a.m. Pacific on November 5th and going straight through to 9 a.m. on November 6th. Wish us luck. Also, James and I are working on a documentary project about queer gamers, and on November 12th, we're going to be live-streaming a sneak peek and responding to viewers' questions and comments. If you enjoy the storytelling on Sewers of Paris, you'll want to join us live for Playing with Pride. It's a work in progress, so feedback at this stage can have a huge impact on its future. Just visit playingwithpride.com to watch and for details, and to sign up for the latest news on the project as it evolves. Now, here's Austin. Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm talking to Austin Bull, a.k.a. The Bearded Femme. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yay. So tell me, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
The key piece of entertainment that kind of outed me, I don't know if it changed my life, but, well, it did because it outed me, but probably Brokeback Mountain.
Okay.
And I think that's probably the case for quite a few gay men. Even seen the film. It was my freshman sophomore year of college. I was going to SUU and living with my parents.
And where's that?
Oh, actually no, this is so in Cedar City.
Okay.
It's like 15 minutes from Parowan, where I was living at the time.
I don't know where any of those things
are. Yeah, it's all just in southern Utah, close to like St. George and Zion's National Park and all that.
Okay, so like small towns upon small towns.
Yeah, little farming Mormon towns, predominantly Mormon.
Okay.
But actually, this was in high school that this happened. So probably my junior year of high school, I was looking at gay love stories. They had gay love stories featured on the Brokeback Mountain website.
Oh, wow.
And so it was just all these couples, like, telling about how they met and fell in love, and I was really, like, you know, you get that, like, tingling in your chest, and you're kind of just, like, fascinated. It's like, I don't know, it opened up a world for me, because they were happy stories.
Mm. Which is very, very much in contrast to the movie.
Yeah, exactly. So it was interesting to hear about all these people who had found each other and fallen in love and kind of their, you know, star-crossed lover stories. And it was exciting to me. You don't have words for it when you're raised in a religious setting and you don't have idols, you don't have mentors. So seeing that, like, yeah, it excited me, but, like, the funny thing is, I hadn't even looked at, like, gay porn. Like, I was a good Mormon boy. Like, no gay porn, no masturbation. Like, I was golden boy.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I just, like, innocently looked at these love stories and didn't think much of it. Just, like, closed the browser. A couple days later, I'm just hanging out in my room doing my thing. And my mom comes in and she tells me that she looked at the browser history and she had seen that I'd been looking at these gay love stories on the Brokeback Mountain site. And all she said was, you know, you can never be happy with that lifestyle, right? And she kind of just left it at that and walked out of the room, like, without really giving me anything to say. Like, I was just kind of stunned. Like, I remember almost, like, wanting to laugh, but also being kind of, like, terrified. It's like, you know, you're basically kind of found out. But there's no conversation after that till much later. So that was kind of the initial, my initial outing.
Wow. And it's so weird because it's not even like, I know what you are. You know, it wasn't like, you're out. Okay, that's it. Okay, yeah. I can start becoming gay.
It was kind of like, she was just like, don't, like, I know what this leads to. Like, don't even think about it, almost. Like, shut it down. And which is so funny because she's not that kind of woman at all. Like, she's very open, loving, like a little bit of like a Mormon hippie. Mm-hmm. But I think just in that moment, she was so overtaken with fear. And so, like, I don't know, I've come to a place where I understand that parents, especially like religious LDS parents, you have this idea of what your child's going to be. Like, I'm sure she had, like, this fantasy of me being, you know, like, a missionary and getting married and producing babies, you know, mm-hmm. like, which is beautiful and fine. Like, that's that mythology, you know, that's the Mormon mythology and the Mormon ideal. But, yeah, when your son, who, you know, is kind of your golden child, deviates from that, I think it's very frightening. And the idea of me being with men, I think, has always also terrified her, like the predatory aspect of it.
Right.
But yeah, it wasn't until the next year when I was, you know, in the depths and throes of depression, and I would come home a lot, and I'd come home from church early, and I would just shut my door, and I would blast music. I would blast Lonesome Crowded West by Modest Mouse, or just mixtapes that I would steal from my sister that her boyfriend gave her, because it just contained all this amazing music full of, I don't know, there's like Interpol and Arcade Fire. That opened my world up, like being able to listen to these singers with all this pain. And like, I was really attracted to singers with like hurt in their voice. Like, you could hear their history in the way they sang, especially Anthony. I remember hearing Hope There's Someone for the first time.
Hope there's someone who'll take care of me when I die. Will I go? Hope there's someone who'll set my heart free, nice to hold when I'm tired.
And like, I heard music, like cello music, like Yo-Yo Ma, like that was always music that I was like, okay, I feel this, like, this deep sorrow, and I need a sound that reflects that, and it was always the cello. But then I heard Anthony's voice, and it took me, like, to a whole nother place, just, like, the way he sings and his vibrato, and there's just so much pain there, and just hearing someone sing about their loneliness or their desire for something more, like, hope there's someone that will take care of me, like, as a young queer male, or like, you know, budding sexuality, and you're alone, you don't have anyone to talk to, and you have those same desires, like, yeah, I hope there's someone, like, if I can't get it here, is there an afterlife where there's someone who will take care of me, who will carry this for me? Because it's like, yeah, I think that was the hardest part of high school, was just having this incredible weight and no one to share it with, and no joy in it. Like, yeah, just so.
What kind of a kid were you?
It's funny. I think I was very... Well, there's a big shift when I turned 14 because a lot happened that year. Like, my dad died, and after that happened, like, everything sort of fell apart. Like, my academic... Like, I think there was a dramatic shift in me. Like, before then, I was a lot more lively. I was a lot more outgoing. And then after that, I feel like I closed up. And I, you know, trauma will do that to you. Like, everything fell apart. My religious convictions crumbled. It was just like a death on so many levels. It was the death of God. It was the death of, you know, this heterosexual ideal of what I thought I could be. And it was the death of my father. After that, I just felt myself close in. Like, I feel like I got really quiet. I didn't like to hang out with people very much anymore. Like, I was always kind. I was respected. People liked me, but I just, like, that heaviness I was talking about, there's always just, like, this weight and this sorrow following you around. I would write a lot. I wrote a lot of poetry. I found a lot of peace in the writings, like, confessional poetry, like Sylvia Plath. Like, she became, like, this mythological figure for me, but she cast herself as that in Ariel, like, her final work. I was really attracted to that, like, this power she found in her grief, this power she found in her suffering.
Tell me a little about Sylvia Plath. Like, how did you find her, and what was your initial impression of her? Because I think a lot of folks maybe will know the name, but don't really know her work.
Yeah, I think I discovered her in an English class. I had an English teacher named Mrs. Harris. She's probably the closest to a mentor I had in high school. She's an amazing woman. But I'm pretty sure we were probably reading, like, a collection of poetry, and I think Daddy was the first poem I came across by her, and just hearing how, like, the power and the rage in her words, and how she kind of casts her deceased father as this, as a agent of Hitler, you know, like a Nazi, like a dictator, basically.
You do not do, you do not do any more black shoe in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or hachew. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time, marble heavy, a bag full of God, ghastly statue with one gray toe big as a Frisco seal, and a head in the freakish Atlantic, where it pours bean green over blue in the waters off beautiful Nauset.
Yeah, she was, I think, like, 1930s, was that the height
of
her? Yeah, in, like, the 1930s. Yeah. Like, she's a confessional poet. She made The Bell Jar. That was her only novel. She had a couple volumes of poetry, but it wasn't till, like, I feel like she reached the height of her fame after her death.
Mm.
And it just has continued to grow because she created that myth around herself. Like, she stuck her head in an oven and killed herself. And after creating this, like, violent, powerful, sad, beautiful work called Ariel, which is, yeah, those were all the poems she wrote, in the months before her death. I found a lot of power in artists who created myths around themselves.
And so she was someone who's living and writing with a lot of pain.
Yeah.
So did that feel like, oh, this is someone that maybe I can't talk to, but it sort of feels like I'm talking
to. Yeah. It's like, I've always related with the damaged feminine because there's such a history of violence attached to the feminine and the resilience of the feminine and the fact that they create us and they are the creators of life and they have to bear this pain. They bear the creatures that do them the most harm. Like, it's such a beautiful, like, horrible thing, but mostly beautiful. It's just, they are just built to take on pain. So whenever a woman speaks out about her pain, or her role in a really beautiful, powerful way, it just speaks to me. Mm. Like, whether it's, like, PJ Harvey with her Rid of Me album, which that was another, like... was a queer album for me, because it's like this woman, the mythology around it too, like she was only eating potatoes, and she's like,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she like only ate potatoes, and she was super thin, and she was just making like this really angry music, kind of mocking the masculine and taking on the masculine role and poking fun at it. Like, I've always loved women who are able to do that, like create myths of themselves. It's, they become like entirely new creatures. It's like they, like, if there's a way to create your own gender, it's creating a myth, like, around it. So, yeah, Plath, PJ, like, the rock stars in their own mediums, you know.
And I'm sure you just didn't have, like, in a tiny town, surrounded by tiny towns, no opportunity to, like, explore what the feminine...
No. Like, it's like a cowboy town, you know, a farming cowboy town. Like, I think that's why, Lonesome Crowded West by Modest Mouse was really appealing to me, because it's kind of dissecting that cowboy myth, like Cowboy Dan. That song is incredible. Like, it's just like talking about this kind of, I imagine this, like this wretched cowboy figure who's an alcoholic out on a reservation, shooting a rifle, trying to kill God. Like the damaged masculine is really interesting to me as well, because it's a myth that can't be achieved. Hmm. It's like this impossible, like the breadwinner is an impossible myth. Like, so there's the, you know, the gender binary just puts this incredible weight on the male or female body. And then those who try to achieve that realize they can't, and they see people going against it in that in-between space. And I feel like that's part of the violence that results from it, is like, oh, like, look at you. How dare you? Like, I'm staying in my role. You're trying to diverge. Like, I hate you, you know? Like,
it's... Did you have any sense, like, at that time, like, what kind of future you wanted?
For a while, like, early, like, preteen, I was all about the church, just because it offered this, like, magical mythology where you could be, like, a god. Mm-hmm. You could be something special. Like, it just, like, was so neat and lovely, like, the idea of being with people you loved in this magical place where you could be a creator, like, that appealed to me. So I always wanted to do something religious, like a preteen, but I always, like, knew I just wanted to create something beautiful. I either wanted to write something on the level that, like, Sylvia Plath had written something, or create music, or create some work of art, or just something that, to me, was expressing my truth or my form of beauty.
What did it look like when you were turning to the church and you were like, this is going to be the venue in which I create, or this is going to be the venue that gives me structure or direction? Like, how did that take form?
I guess just I kind of told you, I was like, I tried to be a golden boy. Like, I knew you get this idea that the more, like, pure you are, the greater reward you will get. So I figured, like, if I stayed as pure as possible, like, I didn't masturbate till I was 19. Mm. Like, I was just,
it's against the rules.
Yeah. I was just trying so hard to be as kind as possible and as conscientious as possible. And it just, after a while, it's impossible. Like, there's just so much shame and weight. Like, I think I exhausted myself. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it just so happened that death came knocking and my dad died, and I couldn't hold that fantasy anymore. This idea that I could maybe be a church leader or be like this righteous person, that it all fell apart. Like, I kind of fell into oblivion. And going back to like that mixtape that I found that my sister's boyfriend gave her. There's this song called I See a Darkness mm-hmm. by Bonnie Prince Billy. And I always feel like that's kind of, that was exactly that, like, I found that song exactly when I was feeling that way. Mm-hmm. Like just staring into, like, this abyss and realizing that there's no one there to catch you. Like, there isn't a celestial figure in robes there to catch you. Like, there's nothing there. And having to find beauty in that darkness has kind of been the process I've been building up to since then. Like, even with the bearded femme, I think that's kind of where I operate from, finding beauty in darkness, like trying to, I don't know, just like the things that seem so obviously, or that you were told were like wretched and evil, you come to discover after, you know, you come out of the closet, you come to discover they're actually really beautiful and wonderful and liberating. So that's kind of that gradual discovery. Yeah, it's just kind of obviously changed the path.
Sure. So, well, tell me about the path. Like, when it sounds like kind of in your mid-teens, you had this sort of crisis where you're like looking into that abyss.
Yeah.
And so how did you explore either going into the abyss or just standing at the edge or looking in?
Well, initially, I think, you know, we know that this is a case for a lot of queer youth, is that you look to death first. And once again, I See a Darkness by Bonnie Prince Billy, it's the conversation that a man's having with his friend, saying, like, I have these thoughts, I have this darkness, like, I hope one day, like, we will find peace, because right now, like, we're both feeling this way. And I think, for me, I was falling into that. Like, my biggest memory of that, like, that reaching its, like, final, like, breaking point was I was a English Sterling scholar, and I was doing my interview, or our mock interview for the Sterling scholar, and I just couldn't do it. Like, I just stopped it. Like, I left the classroom, I left the mock interview, and I just felt, yeah, I felt like I was gonna die. Like, I felt like I was gonna fall apart. And my mom was teaching at the school I went to, and I went into her classroom, and I was just like, I have to go. So I went home, and I spent the rest of the day in bed just, like, listening to music and wanting to, like, be swallowed up. And she came home later, and she sat by the bed, and she's just like, Austin, like, what's wrong? Like, what's going on? Like, I feel like we sat there for, like, 15 minutes, it felt like, before I said, I think I'm gay. And yeah, from that point on, it was just this gradual coming out process. And it was still, like, that was my senior year. And it, like, for the longest time, it was just still that darkness. There wasn't any joy attached to being gay. Like, it was still very much a sad, scary thing. Like, it kind of meant my demise in some way.
Mm. Sure. I mean, like, if your whole life had been like church,
yeah,
and being the good kid, meeting these expectations, then the thing that's going away is all those expectations, that whole life that you expect for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was just, I guess it was also, you know, the death of me as I had known myself, and having to reconstruct what the new Austin was, and having to do it on my own, like, using these pieces of music or these little glimmers of hope as my guides. Like, yeah, it's really weird that, like, these voices on, like, a CD can be your guide, but, like, that's all I had. Like, I didn't, yeah, like I said, I didn't have mentors. I had to kind of build my identity from scratch.
You had PJ Harvey.
Yeah, good old Peach.
I mean, as mentors go, you could do a lot worse.
Oh, yeah, no, she's such a badass.
So, like, what did that look like? So how did you start to explore, okay, I'm gay, I've said the words out loud, what do I do now?
Oh, it was a very, very, very gradual process. I went to therapy for a while, and I had to, like, say it out loud there and kind of work that out. And I didn't, yeah, I was kind of out to the, like, my early college years at SUU to, like, my close group of friends, and I gradually came out to each of them, and they were all cool with it, because, like, I hung out with the freaks and the geeks, and they don't care, they're just, like, but it wasn't until I met and started dating my first boyfriend that it was, like, out in public, like, I put pictures up on, I think I was using MySpace at the time, and, like, and maybe Facebook too. I think, like, there was, like, an intersection there for a second.
How'd you meet him?
On MySpace.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. So ridiculous.
Was he another student?
No, he was living in Vegas at the time, and his family lived in Cedar City, and I was at home writing a paper and just kind of, like, on MySpace, and he hit me up and said, hey, we should hang out. And I was like, okay, I have to finish my paper. I'll meet you later tonight. I'll come pick you up in my truck. I had a little red Toyota. So I drove into Cedar City that night. I picked him up. I was super nervous. I had, like, no gay kiss, no sexual experiences. And he takes me to this make-out point. And, yeah, we just, like, fooled around for, like, 3 hours up at this make-out point. And... it's crazy how, you just feel like your whole body changes after your first lovemaking with another male, like that. Yeah. I just felt like so alive all of a sudden. Like I almost couldn't contain it. Like it's just, you're instantly transformed. Like your first sexual experience. I think it's the case for anyone, but especially years and years of, like, feeling so ashamed about it and then having all this, like, this rush of bliss.
Mm-hmm. It's a real affirmation.
Yeah. And it was just beautiful. And we kind of fell in love from there. And I ended up kind of dropping out of college and moving to Vegas, which in retrospect is, you know, a bad idea, but also a good idea because I was getting away from home. Mm. I was kind of learning the ropes, and it ended up being a really toxic, bad relationship, but I learned a lot from it. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And it got you into the big city.
Exactly. Yeah. I lived in Vegas for a while, didn't like it. So I decided to move back up to Salt Lake and go to the U.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I've stayed, for the most part, I've stayed put.
So how did your relationship with the church change in that time? Were you just like, it's out of my life, or were you trying to, like, balance?
Yeah, well, from 14, like that's kind of like that changed, the year that changed everything. Like, after my dad died and after his funeral, especially, like, Mormon funerals have always been really traumatic for me because I feel like they talk more about Jesus than the actual person, and it's like Jesus is our band-aid kind of thing. And it's always, like, that's been, like, traumatic for me to be, like, this is such an easy fix for something very sad. It's not, like, I just want to, like, scream. I want to feel the full extent of my grief, but it's like, oh, no, like, it's okay. Like, he's with Jesus. And that's always really pissed me off. But, yeah, after that, it was just kind of a gradual disintegration. Like, my biggest memories is leaving church early, like skipping out on priesthood meetings, and once again just going home, like shutting my blinds, locking my door, and blasting Modest Mouse and Interpol and Arcade Fire. I forgot Funeral, that album, like, was so obviously applicable. It's called Funeral. That album changed my life. Like, because it's about the disintegration of innocence. That whole album is about that. And so, like, listening to songs like Laika, based off the, you know, first dog sent into space, and comparing that to the black sheep of the family, like, being cast off, becoming, like, this vampire, I just felt, it's almost like I saw, like, the trajectory I was on, like, oh, I'm gonna be, like, this monster. But it's funny, as I've grown older, I've taken so much power, like, in being the monster. I view, drag queens as, like, beautiful monsters, kind of, like, mm-hmm. queer superheroes. So it's been fun to, like, in retrospect, looking at those hints and signals of what you would be.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
So you were in Las Vegas for a little while, and then you moved back to Salt Lake. And what were you studying when you came back to Salt Lake?
I did creative writing for a long time. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to be a writer for the longest time. I'd written like a 200-page like screenplay in high school and early college. Like, I was just like all about poetry and writing and so that was the first 3 or 4 years of college was creative writing. And then I jumped to film. I wanted to do film for a while. And then I got sick of that. And then I moved to San Francisco for a summer chasing a boy, which, like, you'd think I'd learn my lesson mm-hmm. after mm-hmm. like the Vegas fiasco. But I moved to San Francisco for a summer, which once again, simultaneously like awful and beautiful experience. But those are the things that change you. And that changed my life in a huge way.
How so?
Well, like within the first couple weeks, the guy that I moved there for ditched me. Like, it's like, bye. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm here. I'm going to try to tough this out. So I was pretty much alone and feeling very, like, vulnerable and freaked out, and just wanting to kind of prove to myself that I could tough it. But my friend lent me this book called The Will to Change by Bell Hooks, and it's about the toxic effects of patriarchy on the masculine. Like, it specifically focuses on that, you know, that myth of the masculine I was talking about earlier, how damaging that is for men because they can never own up to it, and it often presents itself in like really violent ways, like the violent patriarch. Anyways, he lent me that book, and I have all these memories of being on BART and like reading it and then just like bursting into tears, like while on BART, like just like trying to like hide my tears, because it just hit me in such a big way. It was like, you know, when you find those truths for yourself and you just like can't, it's like, yes, like this makes so much sense. Like, this is why everything's so fucked up. Like, I was asked to be, like, I was being trained to be this breadwinner patriarch, and I've never been that. I've always been a fairy. I've always been, like, a witch. And then I also read another book called Cunt by Inga Musio. I don't know if I'm saying her last name right. But on the opposite end, that's just, like, a complete, it's relishing in the feminine and the power of the feminine. And that, like, I was just like, yes, like, this is beautiful, another truth. And I remember, like, reading that and crying a lot. Like, actually, right before a job interview, I read a chapter on rape. Like, it was a job interview for, like, Pete's Coffee. And I was like, I'm like, okay, gotta get it together.
Yeah, for this job interview, yeah. And this is on your mind.
Yeah, so it was just, like, I was growing as a person because I was alone, and I was reading these amazing things. And then to top it off, my friend Willard, who's kind of, like, my drag mom, he was living out there at the time, or no, he was visiting from Salt Lake and performing for his first time at the Stud Bar. Mm-hmm. So he invited me to his performance, and that show changed my life. Like, it opened with a woman with tape over her breasts and in a nightgown performing in front of these two screens with women playing with their body fat while she was lip syncing. Like, the lyrics were I'm looking for love, I'm looking for love. And I thought it was so powerful to just see her like owning her body and having these images of women playing with their body fat. Like, I was like, this is incredible. Like, I didn't know this was drag. And then it just got like progressively more amazing from there. Like, Willard with his incredible like catfish gender fuck was just twirling and flipping her braid. And then like, to top it all off, like, Vane Hain, this performance artist named Vane Hain, came out in this garish mask and a full blonde wig. Like, is like a parody of beauty standards. And she took out shaving cream and a razor she started shaving her legs on stage to I'm Your Venus, I'm Your Fire, but it was all, like, slowed down. I think it was, like, the Cyril Hahn remix. And I was just, I was like, what is this? This is beautiful. Like, I have to do this. Like, I didn't know this was drag. Like, I was just so blown away.
What was it showing you about you? Like, it sounds like these books and also the performances. Was there something in you that you're like, oh, this is showing me who I am?
Yeah, yeah. I felt like because I, like I was saying, I'd always felt like that fairy, like that witch, and I was seeing witches do work their magic for the first time. I was like, I have access to this. Like, this is in me. Like, I just need an avenue for it.
It'd been there all along, waiting for you to find the words for it.
Yeah, it was an awakening. Like, it was just like gradual awakening.
So how did you try to express it?
Well, I couldn't cut it in San Fran for the summer, so I'm like, fuck it, I'm going back to school, I'm going home. And I decided to go into gender studies, because I was like, well, that's everything I was reading about over the summer. So I did gender studies for like a year, and just like ate up everything I could, like Audre Lorde, bell hooks, like just absorbing all this like information, queer theory, feminist theory, and loving it to death. But also kind of being bogged down by it, because it's like you are finding your truth, but realizing like, it's like I was given this utopia and realizing we're so far from it. Mm-hmm. So it kind of like all of my conversations in class started to feel like these cycles that just like, we were all just talking about things, but I was like, how, like, we're just talking and I'm getting sick of these conversations. I felt like I was having the same conversations over and over again.
Well, that's very much what academia can be.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just, I felt exhausted. I was having panic attacks. I kind of had a little meltdown. And I had to drop out again. So in the midst of this meltdown, it's like, you know, another death, I discovered the Bad Kids Collective, which Willard had started along with Scotty Ray or Cartel and Tanner, Klaus von Austerlitz, and then Danny Piper as Lamia. They were the original four founders of this genderfuck punk drag collective. Mm-hmm. So I went to a show one night with a friend, and I saw Klaus perform Neverland by the Knife, and he was wearing this mask with blacked out eyes, and he like pulled off this cape, and he was doing this amazing voguing, and the audience was throwing dollar bills at him, and he started shoving the dollar bills in his mouth as the lyrics went, I'm dancing for dollar. Like, it was amazing. I was like, this is it. It's here. It's happening here. I'm dancing for dollar. It was another like, yes. I was so excited by that I started talking to them, and they started talking to me, and they're like, you know, we have this pageant coming up and we're looking for local talent. Like, would you be interested in competing? And so, yeah, like Klaus and Scotty or Cartel invited me, and I did the first pageant, and I won in my category. And
tell me about your performance.
Oh, okay. So, just going from, like, my gender studies background, I wanted to do something that kind of, like, blended, like, the violence of the patriarchy with something empowering and independent. So, I took this song by Death Grips that's very, like, raunchy and violent, and in the beginning I had a mask and a cape, and I just kind of, like, took on, like, this very violent, like, masculine posturing and just kind of was, like, hitting it so hard, and it just felt very, like... I've always been a very aggressive performer. But then it transitions to Declare Independence, and I take the cape off and I take the mask off and I pick up these flags, and I did like a flag dance to Declare Independence, like make your own flag, declare independence. Like I wanted it to end on that hopeful note. Like, look, like you don't have to subscribe to this. Like, find beauty in your own form of expression. Like, make your own flag, like declare independence within your own, like if you were to treat your own body like a country that you have to protect, then declare it. Like, and so that was my declaration. Independence. Do not
even do that to you. Declare independence. Don't let them do that to you. Make your own flag. Make your own flag.
It felt so good. It was another awakening moment.
Had you done performance before then? Like, how comfortable were you on a stage?
Yeah, I'd done high school plays because my mom was the drama teacher. So, high school drama teachers always put their kids into play. Mm-hmm. So I was always, doing roles that just weren't me. I was Lieutenant Cable in South Pacific. These soldier types. It's just
wow.
Maybe my mom trying to butch me up. Come on, honey. But, so I did high school theater, and then I did a little bit of community theater. I did Little Shop of Horrors, which Seymour is a little closer to, my personality.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, because he's a man, but yeah. he completely his character's all about how he wants to fulfill that role.
Yeah, and he can't.
Yeah.
So I was, totally comfortable with that. I was totally comfortable being Seymour, and that was a lot of fun.
But then... there's Audrey, lovely Audrey. If life were tawdry and impoverished as before, she might not like me, she might not want me. Without my plan, she might not love me anymore.
And then a play that actually was probably my first drag experience. I did a student play called Cloud Nine. Well, it's written by a famous playwright, but it was a student directed film. Play. It's called Cloud Nine, and it takes a group of characters and place them in Victorian era setting. And they're all kind of dealing with their repressed sexuality. So I played a woman in the first half and then a gay man in the second half in a different era, but they're still the same characters. So it's just the whole play is this weird gender fuck exploring repressed sexual urges. And it was really wonderful to be able to be this feminine creature in the first half and then be a gay man, play an actual gay character in the second half. And so, yeah, that was actually the last play I did before The Bad Kids. I hadn't performed. It'd been a while since I performed.
It sounds like you had a trajectory from very, very traditional kind of theater.
Yeah.
Getting more and more experimental until you're and here I am, world.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's so beautiful about drag, or at least the type of drag that the Bad Kids are doing, is it's outside art theater. No one taught us how to do this. It's DIY. No one's paying for us or really funding us. We all just decided we were sick of being told what to do and who we are, even within our own community. The group of us is very much outcast in our own community. We don't fit anywhere. So you make your own family, and we just happen to make a very creative family, and we're just going.
Yeah. So what defines Bad Kids Collective? What makes that the family that it is?
I always say the term I like to use is gender anarchists. It's telling anyone who tells you what you are and trying to put it in code to fuck off, but in a creative, playful way. I've always liked artists who are punk in the fact that they almost have there's some animosity between the audience and them, but it's playful. I think we kind of try to do that with our performances. We love you, but we also want you to fuck off. And I feel like we do confessional drag. A lot of our performances are based off of events that we turn into a myth. We are creating myths out of ourselves. The bearded femme is a myth I'm trying to create around myself based on various influences I've had. Like I was saying, it's being a queer superhero. It's so much fun. Yeah, it's beautiful. It has literally saved my life. Like, I was ready to be like, adios, and then I did the pageant, and I met Klaus and Scotty, and yeah.
And you're like, okay, there's a lot to live for.
Yeah, yeah. And it has changed my level of confidence. Like, it has transformed me. Like, I feel like a whole new power in myself and what I can do. Like, yeah, it's been amazing.
What does your feminine side look like physically?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Probably like my drag does, like very, very exaggerated and weird. And I don't know, I feel like I draw from like Toulouse-Lautrec and like Yashitaka Amano, kind of like that very like flowy kind of, I don't know, it changes every time. It's like, that's kind of my philosophy, is like, I want to be a different creature every weekend, every time I put makeup on. Like, I guess my feminine is just this wild kind of angry, hurt, but also like powerful thing. Like it's the matriarch. I want to channel like the divine feminine, like this, like can just as easily hold you as like crush you, you know, like the, I've all like going back to PJ or like even like Karen O or Nina Simone, like these female singers that like, they're so wounded, but they're so powerful. And, or especially Nina Simone, like if you watch live performances of her, when she's like calling out audience members, she's like, sit down. And then she laughs about it. And she like makes fun of the audience and it goes right over their head. Like, she's such a queen. Like that's what my feminine looks like.
How does she dress?
Oh, I like to have something a little bit off-putting every time, something like not quite right. I like things that are a little bit disconcerting, because I think everything's a little bit disturbing when you unpack it. I don't think I ever like look fully pretty. I feel like I have to add like a toilet seat around my head,
sure.
Or I have to like put some weird like tribal paint on the side, or have like a dollar bill with like blood streaming down my eyes, like, you know, making like a statement. Like, I feel like if I'm not saying something about how I see the world in my drag, then I shouldn't be doing it.
Has your mother seen the work that you do?
yeah. Actually, the first performance she ever saw was still probably the most personal I've ever done. I tried to do a Buteau performance. I say try because that shit's hard.
I'm not sure what that is.
Oh, it's a Japanese form of protest dance that started in the 70s. It was started by Heiji Kata. He did it in retaliation to Western influence. So his very first performance was based off a Yukio Mishima novel, and he was queer, so the whole performance was about homosexuality, and he bit off the head of a chicken in the performance, like punk as fuck, like just like, it's like punk Japanese dance, but it's very controlled and beautiful and garish. It's like body on the edge of crisis, like you're supposed to perform like you're constantly on the edge of death, like you're about to expire. So it's really good. Performers are fun to watch because it's like watching like a wounded animal trying to like breathe for life. Like, it's incredible. So having some bearded white faggot try to do it is pretty funny. But I did a performance to Crazy in Love, but the Antony cover mashed up with All I Need by Radiohead, along with a poem by this queer writer about a one night stand. And I just did it as slow and meaningful as possible. And by the end of the performance, I was sobbing. And this was actually a straight venue. It was at an art show, the Pickle Factory. So it's all these straight people, my mom and my sister, like crying with me.
Oh, really? They were really affected.
Yeah. I was really, I was pleased with like that people felt the emotion. Like, like it was a sharing experience. But yeah, my mom, that was the first performance my mom saw, and she was just sobbing afterwards.
She goes from casting you in South Pacific to
before she even had a chance to see it, I would tell her that, like, listen, I'm doing drag, and she's like, remember when you did theater? Oh, honey, you were so good. Like, just like deflecting, like, oh, remember when you were in those plays? Oh, you were so good. Like, you know, just kind of not wanting to acknowledge that her son's doing this. But I've also done a few performances that have really hurt her. And understandably, like I did an Angel Moroni performance, which, do you know Angel Moroni?
He's, I know, like it's a Mormon figure.
Yeah, a mythological Mormon figure. And I recast the Moroni visiting Joseph Smith as a porno, like a 70s porno, because it's like your whole life you're told your lifestyle or, you know, lifestyle or your way of being is kind of pornography. So I wanted to turn that back in their faces and be like, actually, I think this is a porno. Like, so I made a horn out of a plunger and I filled a book full of Magnum condoms. Like they're supposed to be the golden plates, which is what the Book of Mormon came from. And it was actually more, I was attacking just any person, privileged person telling a queer, disabled, a disenfranchised body what to do with their body. Like I used a Joel Coleman speech that my roommate showed me where Joel Coleman, he's a muralist. He's fascinated with serial killers. He's also a performance artist. But he has this amazing speech, just saying, like, you out there, you comfortable ones, you point the finger, but you're the problem. You are the problem. You people higher up who think you have the right to tell the queer, tell the sexual deviant or anyone that they are wrong or evil, you're actually the evil one. So my performance was more about taking something that's supposedly sacred and being like, actually, in another light, this is kind of fucked up. So I had to have some phone calls with family members about that one because I posted it online and we had to have some heart-to-heart.
I can see how that would be difficult for them to see. Challenging.
Yeah, because I did a strip tease, too. So it's like, oh, my son's naked, like, masturbating, pretending to masturbate with the horn, and as Angel Moroni, it's something that's really sacred to me. Like, yeah, I wanted to piss people off, and that's kind of like, I don't know, I think about how I didn't have a chance to really be a teenager, so it's like, in my 20s, I'm now finally to be that little that shithead that I never got to be, so
that rebellious thing.
Yeah.
And you know, I feel like the Mormon Church will be just fine. Like your attack on it will maintain, it will sustain.
Exactly, yeah. And like it's more for me. Like it was cathartic for me. Like I needed to do that. So yeah,
and so it's something that you're getting out of your system, but it's, you know,
exactly.
Also, and you're bringing it to other people.
Yeah, I. People really responded to that performance. Like, I think that's the most gratifying thing is when people come up to me afterwards and say they're inspired. Like, that, you know, that it makes it all worth it when you think you can inspire someone by dressing up and being ridiculous on stage. Like, that's this, like, putting some makeup on your face and, like, when I think about it, I'm like, this is kind of ridiculous. But when someone can be inspired by it, you're like, oh, cool. Like, that's fun.
By you being who you are.
Yeah.
Getting that thing out that's always been there.
Yeah. Because I think the more you own your freak, you know, your freakery and your scary parts and your dark parts, and you display it in a really beautiful way, other people feel more comfortable to own that. Like, who maybe didn't have that courage before. I feel like we're applying like queer feminist theory to the club scene. Like we're trying to create like this communal sense of like, you can be something, a different creature every day. You can be fluid, like create your own gender. You know, you can create your own gender, and that's the power in drag. I've always said drag is your gender on fire. Like you get to create it.
And can people find you online?
Yeah, we have a Facebook page, Bad Kids Collective. Look us up. Instagram, The Bearded Femme, if you want to follow me. And then I have links to my Facebook and then links to all the other Bad Kids. The Bad Kids Collective, SLC, Facebook, find us. Send us a message. Talk to us. We'll talk to you.
Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks again to Austin for joining me. I have seen a lot of drag, and it takes a lot to make me turn my head at this point. So I am 100% in support of any artist who's embarking on something daring and weird. That's why my cautious recommendation this week is Dragula, a brand new drag queen elimination show that's kind of Drag Race plus Addams Family plus Marilyn Manson. It's pretty rough around the edges, but that's kind of the point. The show just premiered online, and it's the work of LA nightlife creatures the Boulay Brothers and upcoming Sewers of Paris guest Johnny McGovern. Each half-hour episode brings together drag queens of a sort you're unlikely to see on Logo. Messy, scary, upsetting, and downright baffling. The show is set in a cemetery, and on the premiere, they're challenged to present their best witch looks. The performers come out on stage cackling with skulls, fangs, and spikes, and they're then doused in water to demonstrate their best death. The judgment begins with the Boulay brother reminding them that, in the Dragula family, we pride ourselves on being outcasts and losers, and there is, therefore, no winner. There is, however, an extermination, with a few queens called out for their unacceptable use of items like sensible black pumps. Three contestants are then buried alive in coffins and showered through a tube with live insects in pitch blackness until one urinates on camera. If the bright lights and beauty of Drag Race have always rubbed you the wrong way, you'll probably love the catacombs and creatures of Dragula. After being showered in mealworms, one of the contestants explains why she enjoyed herself. Quote, "The only thing to do was what I've done my whole life, take something shitty and nightmarish and make it something to laugh about." That line reminded me of something I once read by Annie Prue, the author of Brokeback Mountain. Explaining the message of the story, she said, "If you can't fix it, you've got to stand in it." Thanks again for listening, and please let me know your thoughts on today's show. You can reach me at Matt Baume on Twitter. Just a reminder that this coming weekend you can catch me and my partner live streaming video games for 24 hours straight as we fundraise for Seattle Children's Hospital. Please join us and donate a few bucks to support research into childhood diseases. Just go to sewersofparis.com and click the Extra Life logo to watch and donate. We're starting at 9 a.m. Pacific on November 5th and going straight through to 9 a.m. on November 6th. And please join me and James on November 12th for the live stream of a sneak peek at Playing with Pride, our queer gamer documentary. It's a work in progress, so feedback at this stage can have a huge impact. Just visit playingwithpride.com to watch and to sign up for the latest news on the project as it evolves. You can check out the show notes at sewersofparis.com for video clips of some of the stuff we talked about today, and check out our other podcast, Defining Marriage, for a weekly chat about LGBT equality intermingled with lengthy digressions about obscure movies and chickens and space. If you liked today's episode, just post a note about it on Facebook or Twitter, or leave a review of the show on iTunes like Lil Skank, who wrote, "This show is a must for everyone who has had thoughts on what gay culture is." Thanks so much. Good or bad, I love hearing your thoughts on gay culture, so please keep them coming. And a huge thanks to everyone supporting the Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Each episode takes about 10 hours to produce, so if you're enjoying them, please join the fabulous listeners who are keeping the podcast going for as little as a dollar an episode. Just visit sewersofparis.com and click the Patreon button. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.